My name is Dustin Kelly, but everybody calls me DJ. I'm prior Army, serving as both a Ford Observer and a military police officer. I've spent the last 14 and a half years as a police officer and detective in a large metropolitan police department. Two things that I've learned throughout my career. One, everybody has a story to tell. And two, the best stories are true. This is the DTD Podcast. In 3, 2, 1, and we're live. What's up, everybody? Welcome back to the DTD Podcast. This week in the studio, my guest had yearned to be a Royal Marine Commando since childhood, and in 1986, he enlisted and did just that. After passing the grueling training course, my guest earned his coveted Green Beret in 1987, but that's where the real story begins. My guest spent the next 30 years of his life on active duty, serving in every rank from recruit to captain in the Royal Marines. He has participated in combat rotations to Kosovo, Afghanistan, and was in the lead element in the invasion of Iraq. After active duty, this guest transitioned into the reserves, but at the same time completed a degree in acting and has been featured on stage and screen in roles that were designed to spotlight mental health and PTSD in former and active soldiers. His latest endeavor is an absolutely incredible film called Sunray, which was created by a collection of former Royal Marine Commandos turned filmmaker and actors. This movie challenges the perceptions of mental health and the struggle that soldiers face when reintegrating back into civilian life. It's with great excitement that I introduce into the studio, Tip Colon. What's going on, my friend?
Well, hey, thank you very much, DJ. Thanks for having me on board tonight. I've been really looking forward to this. I'm really glad to meet you, and it's good news I can sort of get the story about things we've got on in the pipeline.
And it's so crazy, the different lives that you have lived. Now, I've heard you say in a lot of different interviews that you've always kind of acted, but I want to go all the way back to when you're a child. You're born in Belfast, 1968. You have seen a lot without even joining the military, a lot of conflict. You talk about bombings and gunshots and different stuff as you were growing up. Can we kind of talk about your childhood and how that started to shape you towards a life in the military?
I think it's quite a weird thing to talk about your childhood. I mean, I can look back in hindsight and see how it was a hard life for a young person living in Belfast and growing up at the time I grew up in. But I loved it. I loved growing up there. I loved the characters. I took for normal the bombings, the shootings, the explosions going off. That was life to me because that's all I knew. I mean, I was born 3 months before the troubles as such started. And it's just what I grew up with. And I had some incredible, a wonderful family. And they come from across the political spectrum as well, you know, both extremist sort of Republican side to the, you know, more empathetic nationalists and, like, you know, getting on with all sorts of people in Northern Ireland. You know, we're just human beings at the end of the day. So I benefited massively from that. And I think having such a strong support network going through the troubles. And I wasn't, let's just say, I wasn't a diamond when I was young. I was a bit, you know what I mean? I was a rough diamond. Maybe, hopefully that's maybe why I took the journey I did. But my family supported me through all these highs and lows in childhood, which again, is a normal family across, you know what I mean? Anywhere in the globe looking after the children. But my family did have, you know, it was a hard time. It's a hard time in that, you know, in Ireland at the time for people growing up. And I think I take for granted the experiences I had. So when I did sort of step up to the mark to become, you know, break the mold and become a Royal Marines Commando, I had quite a lot of experience of what it was all about before then. And, you know, it did help me, but I would never substitute my early days and my life in Ireland, in Belfast, for anything else. It was too important. It was too many wonderful, good people trying to stop the horrible things that were happening. So, yeah, I mean, I learned a lot then before joining the Royal Marines.
Now, your father was a docker. Now, I want you to explain, it's not just of the accent. He did work with ships. I want to talk about that kind of life growing up, though, because it's a very middle-class life. You seem, though, if I'm correct, that's a very middle-class.
No. If you're a docker, right? Well, I mean, when I grew up, obviously, my mother and father, who are great supporters, I'm very lucky to still have them with me. And I think they empowered me to do what I wanted to do. And I think for them to let me do what I did, joining the Royal Marines, becoming a Royal Marines commander, was a very strong call for them to do at the time, because it was a very discreet thing and nobody could know what I was doing because of my background, you know, an Irish Catholic from Belfast and doing what I'd done. And I think in a selfish way, I look back in hindsight and say they have given me the opportunity to do something, but I could have possibly, you know, put them in danger by doing what I did. But, you know, they supported me. They said, like, you know, it's your life, it's your adventure, and you carry on and do it. But the docker thing is a classic. When I joined the Royal Marines, obviously my accent was so much stronger than what you hear today. And when I joined up, they said, oh, what does your father do? And I'm going, he's a docker. I said, oh, he's a doctor. Oh, a doctor. Oh, yes. I said, no. A docker. He works on the boats and on the ships. So, and in the days, my father, he's a very strong, wonderful man. And he was very much a socialist and a union man. And when he was, you know, in the early days, in the 60s, the dockers in Belfast, it wasn't a trade. It wasn't they never had a union. It was you turned up at the gates. If they needed ships unloading, they'd pull the first guys in. And obviously, if you're a regular guy and reliable, then you got pulled in and you would work on board the ships and you're offloading. Obviously, things moved on. They got support. They got union support. They became a salaried trade. And my father was sort of part of that transition. But he was also there at the start of the Troubles when things were really hard for a lot of people in Northern Ireland at the time. So, you know, he's a bit of a hero for me, my old man. Grumpy old bugger as he is, but he is a bit of a hero.
Well, let's talk about that grumpiness. When you first told him, he said, I'm not having a son join the Royal Commandos. Is that pretty much, probably not exactly, but your mom had to kind of step in and talk to him?
My decision was made from an early age that I was going to, you know, my destiny was to become a Royal Marines Commando. And when I tried to join up when I was about 7 years old. Apparently, I was too young, so they sort of said, come back when you're older. So I think my mother and father went, you'll grow out of it. Don't worry about that. But I grew up, and that was my destiny. That's what I had to discreetly be my destiny. I couldn't really tell friends or anything that was my destiny, because I came from a different section of the community where, you know, that wasn't, you know, the perceived, should we say, career choice. When I graduated, in the States, it's the same. When I got to 16-year-old, I done my O levels, which is like, you know, I suppose it's like, you know, a decent educational qualification. However, if I would have put more, should we say, interest and focus into doing those exams, I would have made effort. But again, my focus was on something completely different. So I got my exam results, walked down into the careers office in the centre of Belfast and said, I want to be a Royal Marines Commando. And I was only 16 at the time. So they were going, well, your parents have to sign this, you have to do this. They're going, ooh, I didn't really think how to do that. But yeah, okay. So I brought the documents back home and said, well, this is what I want to do. And my father's words, which, you know, I think he realises, he goes, well, basically his words were, I'm not having a son joining the commandos. And that was quite a, because again, remember, this is Ireland at the time. There's a lot of troops on the streets, commandos being part of it as well. And he said, that's not for me. And he went off to work. And my mum just went, oh, I'll speak to him and see how it goes. And it was signed. So I have to really, really respect that, you know, that decision that my family made to allow me to do what I've done. You know, I'm glad to be still being here in a position where I'm here alive to thank them on something like this, to say thanks for letting me do that and meet the people and have the adventures that, you know, I mean, in the life that, you know, I wanted to do.
Well, and maybe for people that don't understand, you can explain what kind of the problem was there with you being a Royal Marine Commando. Not only that they were in the streets and there was fighting going on, they were dying. That's one whole level to it. But there were so many more things tied to national pride and different things like that that were probably a struggle with your family as a whole to handle. So if you could describe for maybe people why it was such a tough decision and why it was such a sacrifice for your family to do that.
From the family, I mean, I grew up as an Irish Catholic lad in a steady, normal Irish Catholic nationalist /Republican type of a family. You grow up in that environment, you know, a lot of your family are Irish speaking. United Kingdom, the British forces, everything, that's the alien part. And in a lot of respects, the more volatile parts of your family, they're the enemy as such. And I think because society had started to open when I was growing up, and I remember the first time I'd done a tour in Ireland. And remember, Ireland is very, very important to me, not only for my genes and who I am and my clan, but for the wonderful people that are there. And if we can, you know, keep evolving away from the violence, culturally, we're unstoppable. There's such a wonderful, wonderful vibe of Irish people in Ireland. So my choice to actually even serve in Ireland was to stop Irish people killing other Irish people, or British people, or Scottish people, or Welsh people, or Polish people, or Filipino people. All these people have lost their lives for a cause which people of our culture, whether it's a British culture or an Irish culture, we can talk about these things. Those days of having to fight for these things, or fight for those what you believe your causes are, I think are long, long gone. So, I mean, I come from a background where growing up, one of our family friends was killed by the Ulster Volunteer Force, which is a loyalist paramilitary organization. And he was a Catholic, left his girlfriend's house. They knew he was a Catholic, so they picked him up, brought him somewhere, and they shot him in the head and killed him. And I was an altar boy, and the head of my altar in the chapel, he became a policeman, an RUC man. And he got killed in 1985 in the mortar attack in Newry. So these are two friends who grew up together, and they were killed completely from different sides for what? For what? For no reason. These are all the same people. And for me, the tours I had done, both overt and covert, were purely to help Irish people just make their own choices and talk to each other.
It's interesting, though, that you say that the time for conflict and fighting has kind of passed away and that we can talk about our differences. But then on the flip of that coin, you've spent the last almost 37 years of your life in conflicts all over the world. So what have you learned from the Irish and from the problems that they had in Ireland that could be instituted in the rest of the world? Because you spent your whole adult life in conflict after conflict after conflict over things that maybe could have been talked about. I don't know that all of them could have been, but you have seen growth. Where can that be used anywhere else in the world?
I think my experience is not that, but not my operational experience is the realization of, you think about it, no matter who we are, you know, if you're coming from a working class background or anywhere, you come from quite a small community. Even though the world now we're open, we've got internet, we've got everything that's global, but human to human, it's still very much, you know, part of that community. So what your day-to-day routine, if you've not been outside of that bubble, is very much like that. So you don't know really what the rest of humankind is like. Whereas the operations I was involved, both peace support, humanitarian, war fighting, covert, all of them, you realize and you see that human beings are human beings. Good human beings want the same for the whole family. Good human beings want the kids to have food on their table. They want the kids to have education. They want them to grow up. They want them to prosper. They want them to be educated. They want this. And I'm going, that is the same no matter what culture you come from or whatever corner of the world you come from. It's just, you know, simple loving and nurturing, you know, and I've seen that even with people I've been war fighting with and people we've been engaged with and killed, you know, there was no hate, there was no malice. It was a time and place. Everything I'd done, bar I'd say maybe 1%, maybe that maybe, you know, those contacts for maybe 15, 20 minutes, those contacts for an hour, all those things, really, of a 30-year career, they timeline into maybe 3 or 4 days of instant, you know, of life or death experiences. All the other ones, you know, there's always a threat, but everything's there. Everything I'd done most of that career was either, you know, helping people, rebuilding people, protecting people. You know what I mean? So, and in a lot of those cases, the vulnerable people around the world, and there's still so much of it going on. I mean, we don't even have to, you know, talk about, you know, wars or operations that are happening around the world at the minute. For me, as a Royal Marine, was purely to protect the vulnerable and protect my culture and the freedoms that we have. You know what I mean? And believe me, the freedoms that we have, both stateside, UK side, and Europe ways, are, honestly, you can never take those for granted, never, especially in the, you know, the volatility of the world at the minute. And, you know, I mean, look at Ukraine and you're that gone. These are people, you know, that are culturally very similar to ourselves, yet they are literally, and nobody's going to say, no, you shouldn't fight. They're fighting for their lives every single day. For what reason? For what reason? You know, and that's not me being political. It's me being a human being. You're going, why? Why? You know what I mean?
But don't you think with the career that you've had, the life that you've had, you look at things through a different lens than most people? When you say it's not me being political, it's me being a human being. Don't you think you've experienced things, though, that, like I said, would put you looking at life through a different lens than the majority of people would?
Yeah, but that it's experiential. So I've, in a way, when I was a feisty young lad joining as a Royal Marines Commando, and this is true, like, please, I'll probably have a lot of friends if they listen to this. When I joined up, coming from Ireland, I thought all English people and, you know, anyone that wasn't Irish were all really soft. And, you know, they weren't as hard as us, you know, as everything else. And I joined the Royal Marines thinking, right, you know, picture three fundamental things, right? I'm Irish. I must be extremely good looking. I'm going to be a Royal Marine Commando, so I'm going to be extremely hard and be, you know, indestructible. That means I'm going to be the most, you know, attractive item this side of the Pegos Ridge. It's all complete bullocks. You know what I mean? It's all nonsense. So when I join up and I meet my friends who come from, even in our small troop and recruit training, they came from, we had guys from Africa, we had guys from Canada, we'd big black hard guys from London, we got, you know, people from the Caribbean, and we had this gang of people that were so diverse, but I realized that I wasn't as hard as I thought I was. You know, you just met these incredible, like, human beings, and I think that's it. So the fact is, because I broke the chain and moved away from, you know, that insular community where the whole of the universe centered around Northern Ireland, what was happening, the troubles, and then you realize that there's a whole world out there full of human beings that are suffering or being troubled in similar ways. Every time I went on operations, I have felt, and I feel morally, because hopefully I've got quite a strong moral compass, I feel that I've done it for the right thing. And even the people, like I say, when it became to the kinetic battle, I struggled a bit in Afghanistan because I've spoke to people, and I've spoke to a few of our interpreters and a few guys that have obviously come back to the UK. And one of the guys I met was a taxi driver, and I was coming back from the pub one night. I went to Afghanistan. He said, yeah, I was an interpreter, and I was chatting away to him. Really lovely guy. And he managed to get himself away from Afghanistan. And I remembered him when I went to Afghanistan initially. We were up in the mountains in Western Afghanistan, and we were meeting these villages, and these guys, I mean, they were Taliban. Last week, they were Taliban. You know what I mean? Full dish-dash. They're running the madras and everything. And I said, you know, you're Taliban. He goes, no. I'm not Taliban, but there's good Taliban and bad Taliban with the scholars. And I said this to the taxi driver, and the taxi driver said, don't ever say that. They are evil. There's only bad Taliban. So it was really hard for me when we're, in that environment. I never broke anything that I believed, was a Geneva Convention, but I'm just saying it was very hard not to go that, these people are against everything that I believe in, my family, my children, my freedoms, those women going to school, there's that. And it was really, really hard for me to, out of all the battles I've been involved in, including Iraq, and I'm like going, that was a hard one. And nowadays, we're over it, but the sadness of so many people that we lost in that environment to have given up that environment is a very hard one for me to take, especially looking people, my lads that I've lost, we've lost on operations, looking their families in the eyes and going, it wasn't, their lives weren't a waste. It's a hard one for me to take. But when we were in Iraq and that, we used to, and they were including, there was ideological, there was Fedayeen we were fighting against as well. But you just kept, when you were in contact after contact, if you did, there was enemy dead, you felt sorry for them. There was no hate, no malice, And we lost a lot of lads as well, but it wasn't hate or malice. It was just, why are you fighting against something that is, at the end of the day, when we did go into Iraq, we were liberators. We were giving people food, we were giving them water. They were going, they've been oppressed by Saddam Hussein for so long. And, you don't see much of that because it's such an unpopular war. People don't see that you were liberators. You were the ones, and people thought you were thanking us, and crying. And we were just trying to basically make them survive. So really, it's that, I know it's a long-winded way of saying it, but it's when you open the box, see the world, and you're conditioned as you are as a Royal Marines Commando, you're doing something for a reason, and you will do it to the best of your ability. But the people out there, the people I've come across that, in a global sort of like tour of, my duty, they're incredible. But they're so, so similar. Languages, cultures are different, but human beings are just, we need the same things.
While you were saying that, though, I'm thinking from a law enforcement perspective, in the job that I've done, when you talk to these people, because I do a lot of interviews and things, and you hear kind of the same thing, there's good and bad. And it's very hard for me to break that line where they say, well, I did it for this reason, and that makes it okay that I did it. And you get that struggle in you. What I feel, though, that it has done is turns you jaded towards the war.
Yeah.
There's no way around it. And if anyone tells you that they haven't become at least a little bit jaded, that's a lie. Just from seeing the things that we saw. I want to go back to kind of your childhood, though. And I looked up something that you were very fond of when you were a kid, Behind the Lines. Was what gave you the reason, I think, to be a Royal Marine. You saw them. And how you describe yourself when you first went to the Royal Marines is episode one of Behind the Lines. When they're talking to the captain, they're talking to the sergeant that are there. These guys are just full of life and full of, I guess you would say, themselves, but what they were there to do. That was a mission that they were there to do. Can we talk about how you saw that, and when you got actually to the Royal Marines, did you have that same feeling that you had so many years before when you saw those kind of things?
I did. Like, but when Behind the Lines came out, it was a year after they filmed it. I think it was the course of 1983, the year after the Falklands War. So most of the guys that were on the Mountain Leader course at that time were all, for majority were veterans from the Falklands War. And, I'd been in war fighting scenarios in a pretty bleak and, hard war. But that was on, I'd already, my decision to become a Royal Marines Commander was already signed for me anyway, in a discreet manner, was completely, that's what I was going to be. But when I seen this and I seen Royal Marines Mountain Leaders, I seen what they did, the output, the challenges it involved. And for me, that if I was able to get through the initial challenge of become a Royal Marines Commando, I wanted to become one of these icons. They were legends. And bizarrely, through the years, a lot of the guys on the television program are now friends of mine. And they're, it's it's quite bizarre that, you know, you used to watch them on the telly, and then you become, they're friends of yours now, but they went on to become just, you know, I mean, incredible Royal Marines from the rank of corporal, and they all done it. In fact, I worked with one of the guys in the program, Russ Craig, when we first went to Afghanistan. He was the regimental sergeant major for 4-5 commander, which we deployed with. You know, I count these people as friends now, but when I seen Behind the Lines, I just went, no, that's the business. That's what I need to be. And thankfully, you know, I was spurred and never got injured and stayed focused. And that's what I became.
If anyone wants to check that out, it's something that you really should to see this. I think it was very ahead of its time and the things that it focused on, the things that it showed, and even the operational security that it showed of what was going on at the time. If you want to check it out, you can. You can go on YouTube, go on the internet, just type in Behind the Lines, and it'll bring up, I can't remember how many episodes there are, but it's pretty great to watch it.
Yeah, DJ, I knew you'd like that. I knew you'd like that. It is, isn't it? It's one of those, it still holds its credibility, doesn't it?
Absolutely, I think so. And that's why I say that it was so ahead of its time, just for the way that it portrayed what was going on. Because, I mean, like you said, it's what, 3 years? It comes out 3 years before you join. But I think that a lot of that stuff held for a lot of your career, because you, like a lot of guys that have been on my show, kind of came in, and with your career expanding as far as it did, you kind of saw three different sides to a military. You saw, you know, where there's things going on. You weren't quite in yet with the Falklands, but you did see that, the tail end of it, the stuff that the people that were coming back from it. You saw war with, you know, with Desert Storm, with Iraq, all those things. And you saw Afghanistan. You saw the global war on terror. You've really seen everything that a military can kind of be put through. You have been put through. And I want to talk to you about that, because when you go very first, there are things going on, but it's not ramped up to the level it was after 2001. So if we can kind of talk about how your career progressed, being a mountain leader, doing everything that you wanted to do, but still evolving slowly into almost a full-time combat readiness.
Before Kosovo, I spent from 1998 to 2003, I was on operations every year. So that's 5 years of full-on operations. And that started in Ireland through to Kosovo, through to Afghanistan, and then into Iraq. And that's before I had a break. So I was 5 years of on task as such. But what I did also see, because in my early days, when I first went to my first commando unit, 4-2 commando, obviously to me, I seen as a stepping stone to becoming a mountain leader, was to go into the unit reconnaissance recon, you guys call it. And there was this bespoke sort of selection process for that, which obviously was quite physically intense, to get into this small band of people. And I managed to get in there. And so, but in those early reconnaissance days, so I joined Recce Troop in 1988. And really at that stage, we hadn't, you know, ISTAR, the wonder that ISTAR is, which again, it's not only military. I think it's across the police departments and everything, you know, that ability to use surveillance from the air and all sorts of, like, you know, different types of digital surveillance capability, which is incredible. But I'd done it in old school, you know, with cameras that had wet film, with the same sort of like technology and training TTPs that we had from, I'd say, you know, the Second World War, and maybe Vietnam, drawn on that, Korea, Vietnam, and through all the different years. So you draw on all the other nations and you move on your TTPs and get their level. But at that stage, we hadn't done the full jump into the digital world. But by, I'd say, early 90s for us, like mid-90s, which started, like, you know, digital cameras, like, you know, video work, and then it just escalated. After we'd done, you know, Desert Storm happened, you know, that was when I think America brought the first sort of ISTAR into it. And then after that, we sort of escalated up. And by the time we got to before 9/11, when we were in Kosovo, we were working with our allies, with Americans out there as well. The digital technology that we got was really at a high level. Wasn't much investment, I think, from the UK armed forces into the full sort of like, you know, delivery of it, you know, as in sending, you know, live, you know, live image transmissions and that there through satellite and everything else. So they still hadn't got the budget for it. But then 9/11 kicked in and then we're full on. So now we've got the full framework of the digital battlefield from when I joined up, which was similar to the Second World War in a lot of respects. You still relied upon that hard, somebody say, industrious young, you know, soldier or Marine who's able to improvise, overcome, adapt, and be there with his rock and his weapon and carry on task. But nowadays, it's a revolutionized battlefield, very much like being like me and you. You're in Dallas, I'm in Devon, and we're chewing the fat. Things have just moved on so much, and I think it's beneficial because again, it brings down, I think, casualty rates, both collateral and like friendly forces. But you know, at the end of the day, we're still optimizing, you know, and I think it's not there yet, but it'd be nice to make it in some way that, you know, it'll never be obsolete. War will never be obsolete. You know, to be say, aggression towards other factions will never be obsolete. I think we just got to minimize it and just try and evolve all the ways of delivering decision making, really.
You know, when you say that it's evolved, it has, and they're taking steps. I mean, where they're trying to remove with drones and all those kind of things, that human element out of it. But I would say with you, that human element can never be out of it, though. There always has to be a human element involved, because when you go to totally autonomic-like responses from a robotic experience, you have to have those guys on the ground that are able to make split-second decisions that will affect everyone's lives around them. And I think you would agree with that you're always going to have that human element of it.
No, I do. But I also think those people that are on the ground, there should be a lot more investment in their, one, their professional capability and using the, you know, technology that's out there, but also in the leadership and command levels. We really need to not only, I mean, because I, and please, for all my officer friends, not to disrespect me, but I've met so many officers that seem so political rather than, you know, human. You know what I mean? And the true leaders are the ones that you can completely tune into. They have utter respect because they lead by example, they do by example, and they achieve things. And I think with the advancement in technology, there's just a fear sometimes, because mission command for me was I had, you know, the autonomy to deliver in a small team of four men, you know, behind the lines, cracking on with it. We didn't worry about it. We didn't worry about the threat. We were just doing our business. But we had the autonomy. But nowadays, you've got a digital tracker, and you'll have somebody who's in a very nice, safe headquarters, an ops room, giving it, I think you're in contact now, you should move right. And you're going, I really don't think, you know, you could go a bit Clint Eastwood in this one. You can go like that. I don't think that's right. You know what I mean? Because he's, you know, it's that's that. No, that micromanagement instead of mission command, when you empower people and lead people and they carry on with it, I think we're stepping back. And the ownership of risk is now at a higher level. So the independence of thought within the military, again, that's being suppressed in a way. It's not completely. We just got to go have a new system and get around it. But I still like that freedom of thought with somebody who's been trained and empowered and is a true leader. I think, you know, especially in the subunits and smaller command, you need that, I think.
With having trackers, with having body cameras, with having all these things that people can watch and Monday morning quarterback or say, well, I would have done this differently, or I would have moved this way, or I would have done that. It's very easy to do that. And I think you bring up a very important point and a very important problem that we have not only in the military and law enforcement, in a lot of different first responder jobs. We have a lot of people telling the people that are on the ground doing the job how they should be doing it. And I don't just mean the command, because you can have good command, you can have bad command. Yeah, yeah. But if you look, you even have the public inserting themselves into it now. Not, and I'm not just speaking from law enforcement, I'm speaking from a military standpoint. You have civilians and people that have no idea and will never understand what's going on, putting their two cents in.
Yeah, and I think we need to get some sort of framework just to cover that and just give, you know, these people that are, you know, on the coal face, the people that are, you know, at the teeth end, law enforcement, the blue light services, and you must admit, these are the people that they make the difference. Whether you're the, I mean, in the military world, it's the, you know, the, you got a piece of land, you got to get there, you know, the person, the most important thing, all those things, all those ships, that aircraft, that's it, those governments, everything, it's all about that first person that bimbles up top of that hill and puts that little flag there, does that. Everything else is in support of that person. If we're starting to control that person who's got, who sees it with his own eye or their own eye and sees what is happening, you're going, hey, to me, you know, from my experience as a soldier, it's just quite scary. You know what I mean? It's, and we know how powerful our, you know, our ISTAR frame is now, but it's just, there's a certain level of humanity is needed in leadership and dealing in a team. And I think maybe in a lot of corporate worlds, maybe they're forgetting that. That it is about, it's about human beings that make it happen. So, you know, you empower, you entrust, you give it, you pick the best, you push them forward. But it's all about people. It's not about technology, is it really?
No, and that's the thing, you know, humans versus hardware, and it should be humans over hardware. But a big point that you bring up with that, with the corporate world, with law enforcement, with the military, I think another problem that you have is, I'm starting to see a dangerous trend, and it's been there for a while, and maybe you've seen it too, where people are more worried about career aspirations than learning the job. What do I do to get to that next step? What do I do to move to the next place that I want to move to, instead of learning the job, learning everything that it has to do with? And so you get people in command positions, you get people in leadership positions that have never known what it's like to stare that down, making decisions on guys and girls that are doing it every day, all day long.
No, but I fully agree with you. But know the bit when you say you're learning the job and you experience it and doing it. But the things of my time in the Corps was I absolutely loved it. I loved the bond, the people, the hijinks, the low jinks, everything. I loved it. So the experience. So whatever you're in, whatever business you're in, if you can have a team where you completely submerge yourself in the business you do, whatever the business is, but you have that, you have friendship, you have bonds, you have support, you have all those, you know, those dynamic things that the human beings have. Because of my experience, and you've seen it as well, is the old, when you go through hardship or arduous things now, and you work as a team, and you do that, and you do have a bit of dark humor as well and everything else, but that is unforgettable. That even in my life now as an actor, it all peels into insignificance until those dark moments where I was there in the, you know, the coldest, wettest, most honking environment in the world, waiting to get shot at. But I looked across and see my mates, and they have a little smile on their face, and they're going, that is what it's about. Because we're all there, we're all focused, we're all there, part of the team, but it's the experience. So it's not just learning the job and making yourself out there and being a buff and reading things off. It's about just submerging yourself in and going, right, this is it. And when you do get the leadership, you get the leadership because everyone respects you and you're the leader. Because you can go, right, let's do it. Because you're the leader of a team, but you're part of the team. So you're not the leader going, yes, I'm better than everybody else. You're the leader because you all think I'm good and I can do this. I think I could. So help me with it and let's run with it. There's so many things. But I'm not selling that I do sort of like management sort of talks or anything. That's not it. I'm just doing it from my experience, my life. And that's the only thing I love. And I think in a lot of ways, our system, sort of society, our society, which is run by, you know, a safe system of society, takes that away, the human aspect, where, you know, you can take those highs and lows. So I think, you know, maybe more human, less machine. But I know that we're in a very challenging time now, more so than even the last, you know, 10, 20 years, because you've got AI coming in. Especially me, I'm an actor now. So I'm like, going, I'm like being an actor. I like being the dodgy Irish bloke or whoever I get cast as and do. I love it. But the fact is now they can go, we can make somebody just like you on a computer and yeah. Like keep her.
Yeah.
And I'm going, I'm like, Jesus, better than me?
Yeah. And that's the whole thing. All right. You have 10 operational deployments, 3.5, 4 years, probably closer to 5 years of actual deployment time away. I want to talk about certain ones. I want to talk about Kosovo, Afghanistan, and Iraq with you. And the reason I want to talk about those is we kind of talked before the show. We're going from different levels. Kosovo is a very quiet, very intimate, getting in there, getting the information you need. Afghanistan, the world is involved. Iraq, the world is involved. So let's talk about the beginnings in Kosovo and then going to kind of the transformation that you make in Afghanistan and Iraq.
Well, Kosovo was, as an organization, we have the sort of formation reconnaissance for the commando brigade. So we're like the newer version of the Mountain and Arctic Warfare Cadre, which were involved in the Falklands. So we're the brigade patrol troop, part of the brigade reconnaissance force. And this is, we were just starting to step up with our, you know, with the reconnaissance and, like, you know, specialists in mountain and cold weather warfare, but also we're building engineer, sort of combat engineer support, commandos, all commando trained, plus, you know, air controlling and, you know, with, you know, different factions in it. We were creating a force. And it was, I mean, people come with different cap badges or different backgrounds, but we merge them in, give them a fundamental course, and we create this, you know, composite reconnaissance element, which is a, you know, it's a one-star tool, but working a lot of times the two-star and maybe, like, you know, with national groupings as well, if needed. So the first job we had when we went out there, and I think I'm beyond the sell by date, was to, we had to secure, help secure using, it was a multinational job, but we had to secure a hotel facility near Mitrovica, which was belonged to Slobodan Milosevic's cousin. And we'd been there one day and we had, we still hadn't even been given our ammunition yet. And we'd M203, so we'd had to get 40 mil as well. So going, and that wasn't allocated in the operational sort of ammunition. So we had to bum and steal ammunition and 40 mil and that off. And we set off, and it was quite good because we, you know, it's a classic when you're, I mean, I was a sergeant by then, but when you get young guys, you give it, oh yeah, you'll never do this for real. You know, when you're in the back of a truck driving out and doing an exercise, or, you know, when the helicopter never turns up and all this sort of stuff, used to be, oh yeah, we should be parachuting in, we should be doing this, we should be doing that, we should be fast roping in from helicopters and all this. And on this our first operation in Kosovo, we had to drive, we had to meet up with the Danish battalion, and then they put the whole of our organization in the back of one truck, one of these large 90-seater, you can't bend it, Scandinavian trucks. We drove over the back of this hill, parked up outside the target's house, and carried on from there. And I'm going, yeah, it's just one of those things that it'll never happen for real, but it does. And we'd done that, but that ended pretty, that was the first up. We were there literally a day, straight on task. When we arrived, we knew that the op had compromised anyway, because the call signs that were covering the actual target were compromised. It was empty. And then we had to deal with a special police team that came in. And, you know, they're multinational, no names, no pack drills. But let's just say, as soon as they get off, we were saying, like, the door's open, I think you don't have to do it. But they were like a SWAT team. They just come in, loads of noise, kicked open the door, was made of plate glass, nearly cut one of the first bloke's legs off. They had no medic with them, so we had to sort the medic out and get him stitched up. And then they went through and trashed the whole hotel. And we knew there was no targets in there. And I'm just, you know, there was no listening. It was just like a political drill. So we went through this evolution, and it happened what happened. There was no target. There was no. You know, there's no one was killed or anything. It was purely just a cleansing, or sort of like a clearing exercise of this hotel. When we finished that, we moved down. We had to link up with the army group that we were working with. But as we were coming down, things were getting pretty tasty. And there's a lot of riots, a lot of weapons were going missing, and rounds were starting to come back into the crowds through Serbian and Albanian extremists. And we get told, right, on your way down, could you secure this roadhead? And it was basically a railway bridge, and there was three roads leading into it, and we'd like 30 guys, and all we had was a helmet and a body armor, purely because we thought we were going into kinetic battle, but we had no like riot gear protection out there. It was purely, you know, we're ready for a thing. And and we had to sort of hold off about 300 locals who were getting pretty irate, and there was rounds going down behind us, and we thought, ooh, we've been here like less than 48 hours. And things, and we got 30 guys with about maybe what, 300-400 people wanting our blood. And we're going, ooh. And we're just holding it with a reserve guy. Rounds were going down, so we sent blokes off to try and track down where the shooter was. And I love Norway because I spent so much time up there as a mountain leader. But then I heard this massive roar of a CSU vehicle, and it just came around the corner with a Norwegian flag on it. And all these Norwegian, you know, team get out with their full rag gear, went, hi, hi. And I was like going, I have never, ever felt as grateful for Norway in all my life. Is that literally, we are literally at a hair's breadth away from getting absolutely ripped to pieces by this very, very sort of like, you know, volatile crowd. So that was within 48 hours. After that, the tasks we done were, like I say, a lot of them were classified. We couldn't even talk about it, but we were working in a, you know, we were working, observing into the demilitarized zone. We've seen a lot of extremist camps, people training people. We were operating against a lot of people that were killing people. And one of the jobs we were on actually got compromised, and there was an explosion involved with it. We've done a few ambushes, and yeah, it was, even though it was quite, should we say, it wasn't a fighting to take the ground, we had to sort of like really exploit the intelligence sort of situation. As an organization, we were punching very, you know, well above our weight. And I think anybody that knows that what we did when we deployed and what we achieved was pretty substantial.
Well, I want to ask you about Kosovo. Do you think that there was some confusion that, because there's a lot of war crimes going on, there's a lot of looking for war criminals. Do you think that there was a confusion of, we should treat this part of it as a police action, we should treat this part of it as a military operation, and they kind of just threw them all in the pot together and used one tool to go after everything, when maybe splitting it up into different things could have worked better to their advantage?
It did, but I mean, I think it was still, it's a trial period, I think, for United Nations as well. And we had a lot of UNMEC police, they're multinational. And in fact, I'd say it was saturated by UNMEC police, you know, officers from the globe. And I don't think their terms of reference or the mission statement was giving them, you know, this is what you have to achieve. You know, I'm not fully aware of it, but the jobs that we done were for, they were directed by K4, General K4, and I'd say national level jobs as well. So ours were very much military jobs. You know, we were directed against extremists that were targeting UNMEC out there, as I was aware. And we, the lads did support when they needed cordon operations and that there. I know the lads from the commando units did. It was for, you know, supporting civil police to do jobs. Because there was a lot of, like, there was prostitution, drugs. There was a lot of things initiated from, you know, shall we say, other more volatile nations supporting there. And we done the more higher level jobs, working against, you know, the people that were the conduit or moving across the borders trying to do stuff. But we were trying to do more of a strategic military job. And that was what our targets were. It was against the extremists rather than, and that's both, you know, Serbian and Albanian that we were working against. But the Marines and as general would support the civil police and the UNMEC doing civil taskings. But it was, you know, they were focused on, I'd say that were, obviously it was, I think there was a lot more of it happening because it was in a, you know, it's one of those scenarios where there's no sort of law and order. So they create their own. So they create their own system. There was a lot of, I'm an actor now, so you think about it, film work, there was a lot of copyright laws infringed when it came to, like, let's just say as well, there was a lot of cars that were stolen from other parts of Europe and, you know, they were pushed through, you know, Kosovo to get them sort of like in some way to wherever they had to be. So there was loads and loads of criminality, which I think was important for to have military personnel to support the, you know, the civil part and the UN police that were there.
All right, let's talk about Afghanistan. You go in shortly after 9/11. Mountain leader, you've worked in the mountains. This is kind of you guys' bread and butter. How is it going to Afghanistan? First off, what are your thoughts going to Afghanistan? Because you've seen the attacks that have happened. You know that there's still things that are going to happen further down the road in the UK. What's your thoughts going into Afghanistan at the beginning of all this?
When obviously 9/11 happened, we were preparing at the time with still in the Brigade Reconnaissance Force, and we were preparing to deploy to the Oman to support a brigade level desert exercise with an armored brigade as well. So it's Saif Saria, I think it was called. And that was happening after the summer in 2001. So 9/11 happened. We're on the ranges. We watched it on one of those little mini TVs. We were just, all of us, I mean, we just come back from Kosovo. A lot of us have been on operations for quite a few years. We just looked at each other and went, our world, you know, and all of our worlds had changed forever. You know what I mean? And the sadness of it all, I think it was just a realization. And a lot of those people that stood around and we looked at those TV screens are no longer with us because they died through operations that were involved with, you know, the war on terror as such. And after that, we deployed to the desert, but we would keep getting, you know, there was just J2 or intelligence feeds coming in like, this is it, this is going to happen. Afghanistan's happening. So obviously 40 Commando and a few of the units with the SBS went in and got involved in Bagram, secured Bagram, and things were, you know, escalating up. We got the nod about Christmas time that we'd be deploying after the new year in 2002. So we flew out, and it was quite spooky actually, because I remember it so well. When we flew into Kabul rather than to Bagram, and when we flew in a C-130, and all blacked out. Everyone was out. We were tooled up. We had weapons as well and ammunition at that stage. And we flew in dark, like, you know, it was a dark flight in, and we landed on at Kabul. I watched a series of BBC just done, the last flights after, you know, the US Marines and our paratroopers and that there, when they'd done the at Kabul airport. And it was exactly the same way. And it was, it tweaked a little, you know, I mean, emotional, you know, thing. And I just thought, because I can remember the noise, you know, and that smell and the way we were at the time, just we were landing on. And it was quite spooky. So we landed on there and we got straight out there. So we're still wondering, because obviously a lot of the ground had been taken, a lot of the Northern Coalition, it was called, had sort of secured the ground. But there's so many pockets of Taliban, or that, you know, they've all sort of changed their suit for the day and went and done something else. So our first job was, at the time, was just after Shahi Kot, and when the guys from the 10th Mountain, the Navy SEALs and that, you know, it was pretty hard old battle up there. And one of the cabs had been taken out and was still up there as well, so that had to be recovered. So one of the first jobs we had was to basically go back into the Shahi Kot with, and we were the lead element in small teams. I was a team commander in charge of a 12-man team with an FAC, a forward air control team, a tactical air control party, so we can call in air and guns if needed be. And we landed on, our LP was at 3,300 meters, which is, you know, I mean, it's twice the height of, you know, more than twice the height of any mountain in the United Kingdom. So it's the same height as some of the huts that we climb in the Alps, you know, when we're climbing up to do, you know, high mountains. So we landed on. So when I was given my orders, I said, make sure that, you know, we're mountain troops, so make sure you carry, you know, have a sleeping bag, one between two. We don't know what way the, you know, the way the lapse rate's going to happen, how cold it's going to be up there. We don't know what, you know, it's going to be a dry, arid mountain, but then we're like 3K up. So, you know, the chances are mountains can bite you in the ass as such. So make sure we carry our kit, a mountain kit and that, you know, keep it in the bottom, sleeping bag 50-50. But remember, there was no water up there, so we had to carry water. We had to carry 51 mortar bombs, you know, we had 51 mortars, so we had to carry mortar bombs. We had to carry GPMG or 7.62, or it was M240, you guys call it? 7.62, so with GPMG ammunition, sniper rounds, sniper rifles. So with a lot of kit, ballistic protection as well. And we were landed on top of this mountain in broad daylight, which had been a severe battle scene for that. You know, it was quite a lot of bodies about still in the valleys as well. When we landed on, we tried to achieve comms straight away on our SATCOM, no joy. And within 50 yards of our LP, our landing point off of Chinook, we had a cave entrance. So I got the mobile phone out, a satellite phone, I'll give it. Right, we've got an entrance for us. Can we go kinetic this time? I want to just obviously deploy a few grenades in there. They're going, no, weapon safe. So I had to we had to sneak past with all this kit. Like a comedy movie, as guys are covering these teal, and the, you know, this, the whole area has been like, you know, a Taliban or Mujahideen sort of area. And we're like going, but that was our first exposure. So, you know, you're not taking any chances. So, but they said weapon safe. So we held her and covered it, dominated a lot of the area. We stood out a bit, but we had good sort of like protection from fire. So we could dig in and we could like, you know, cover. So they knew we were there, but in a way, maybe they want to have a go. So, you know, we'd racked up quite a lot of air in that there. So we had good cover if we need be. But within 24 hours, we're under 3 foot of snow. So dry Arab mountain. 24 hours, 3 foot of snow. And I was looking across, and obviously the guys had improvised, and it was quite good having the snow initially. It burnt off by mid-morning anyway, but just that, it just sort of cemented in where we were, and we had good positions. But we were there for 4 or 5, cleared the area. Loads of people come up to see us. We were waiting for somebody to have a go at us, but it never kicked off. Most of the jobs we'd done was over in Cowston and the Western thing. We'd done a lot of work with Navy SEALs as well. Over in the western part, in the mountainous area of this before we went to Helmand and in later tours, but we spent a lot of time over there, and it was quite hard because we visited a lot of areas where nobody had seen the Taliban, but you could obviously, you know, you knew that this is just part of their culture. But I met some pretty incredible people that had been through a hell of a lot of wars, and met some really, really good people. And I also met a lot of people that their hardship and what's been thrust upon them by the Taliban is, you know, I mean, it's pushing them back, you know, to, I don't think it's positive anyway, but it's just pushing them back to new semi-biblical times, you know what I mean? And, you know, just in their laws, their regime, their, you know, the way they're living. And I think it's not for me to say about it, but it's just something, it's quite sad because, again, the human beings, like they said, they just want the best for their people, don't they?
With Afghanistan, after 9/11 happens, a lot of the guys in the military that are going over there, they're fighting because our country was attacked. They get a very patriotic go from that. That's what spurs them into service. You're not from the United States, but you're over there fighting. What is it about it that drives you on? What is it that gives you your spark in Afghanistan, in Iraq, when you're helping out U.S. forces?
Helping out U.S. forces, but it's not. It's that beacon of what do you stand for? What do you fight for? You fight for your own kind, and our kind are not dissimilar at all. You know what I mean? The mere fact that we can chew the fat, we can share the same, you know, the stories and lives and families and cultures, and that's what we fight for. And although, you know, obviously 9/11 happened, but I mean, subsequent to that, we've had 7/7 in London with bombs going off in buses and things like this continual stuff. But it's also when you realize, and we can't unrealize it, even in our world where we're sort of like, you know, it's not appeasement, but I'm not saying you can't unrealize that culturally, the fundamentalists in Afghanistan hate everything we stand for, hate our family ethos, hate our support to, you know, self-choice, hate, you know, just, you know, everything that we stand for, they just disagree with. It's against their culture. So it's not even a fight for ground. Well, I mean, is it the same as the Second World War? I mean, it's not. I mean, it's, and this is, I'm not anti, you know, people that are, you know, fundamentalists, but it's the fundamentalism becomes extremism when they're starting to take other people's lives. I think it's wrong. And I'd say that's the same back in Ireland. If you want to kill people, you need to be stopped killing people because, and everybody says, well, but you're killing people. I said, no, yeah, but that's not the intention. The intention is to stop people doing what they're doing. And I think that's every time I've done or even pulled the trigger was to protect people or take a position so that people can have a better life.
And I think we're going to get into that a little later on because that is a point that I'm having trouble when I think about your story, when I read about you, when I do the research on you, I see that being trouble as you become an actor, those very different viewpoints of the world. So I want to get into that a little later. I want to talk about Iraq, 2003 on insurgent, you lost 8 members in a helo crash and then 4 USMC. Can we talk about that story, what was supposed to happen, what that operation meant, and then after it's over, you see this catastrophic loss, what it meant to you?
It's quite bizarre. When we got the heads up that Iraq was going to be an option, and 3 Commander Brigade was sort of brought in with the U.S. Marine Corps under a 2-star U.S. Marine Corps general. And that was obviously agreed nationally that would happen. And it was using with the SEAL team as well to secure the manifold on the south part of the Al-4 Peninsula, secure the town, clear up through Al-4 to Basra. And that was going to be the Commander Brigade's task. As I was now promoted, I was a second in command of the Brigade Patrol Troop. And we were the focal point of the Brigade Recce Force for this operation. And our job was initially to, whilst the SEALs and 40 Commando landed and secured the manifold, we had to fly forward in subunits, in team units, to put in an observation post screen behind the lines, covering for any Iraqi reinforcements heading south from Basra. So, I mean, that was it. Our initial part of it, we were OPCON to 4-2 Commando. So we were Operational Command of 4-2 Commando for the first phase of the operation. And then after the first phase, we would switch and become Operational Command to 40 Commando. And we would lead the clearance and do the forward reconnaissance up the Al-4 and into Basra itself. And the heads up we had an issue was that we would take Saddam Hussein's palace in Basra. And that was like, you know, that would be the end of our war as such for us. And, you know, that's happened. So we got our orders, everything happened. We had the US aviation come off, US Marine Corps aviation come off ship, and they were with us, and they were sort of like getting their flying hours at night up and, you know, getting their time under their belt. And then we got our orders with these guys, and that was it. So we'd done rehearsals the night before. So this is about the 19th of March, 19th, yeah, 20th was when we were starting to move, and 21st, you know, in the early hours is when it crashed. So we done rehearsals, but my helicopter, I was basically the Bravo headquarters for the squadron. So the Alpha headquarters were at a different OP, and if they had got taken out while we're on the ground, then I would coordinate and bring the BA sort of like terminal guidance to bring the other teams in off the ground and get us back behind our lines. And so I was the Bravo headquarters, and I was with a forward air controller team or a food team to control fires if anything came up or came down south from Basra. And so we'd done the rehearsals, and my helicopter, and we'd done it. It was, you know, it's a bit of a roller coaster, you know, cracked on with it, landed on, got ourselves out, cab closed down, shook hands with the pilot, said, tickety-boo, we're all sorted for, you know, whenever we get the green light. He goes, yeah, I'm good to go. And we went back to our tents. And then we actually watched, the last night before we went into Iraq, we watched Band of Brothers. So we sat down and watched that. And then next day, that green light, it's happening. So tooled up, obviously we've got all our kit, our ammunition, we're all ready to go. And we moved forward under their division to line up behind our helicopters. And as we lined up behind the helicopters, my Alpha headquarters was at my helicopter. And they said, Tip, you're not in this helicopter, you're on the next one. So this is my helicopter. I'm going, whoa, your grade, your LP's, you know, about 10K away from mine. You know, what's the score? We need to get this sorted. You know, they said, yeah, sorted. So I went up and I seen the other pilot of the 46 that was beside us. He's an incredible guy. He's like, hey, I worked with you guys before. And he'd spent a tour with our naval flying squadrons in the UK. So he'd flown with our guys. So he even knew the bit of British banter as well, which is quite good. Like, but you think so. I had a chat with, you know, him and that all sorted. So we're all good to go. I'm happy. But what hadn't happened at this stage, the helicopters had changed. I don't know why you think of the importance of orders for what we were doing forward of, you know, in behind the lines, and the helicopters change who was on it. But what hadn't changed was the white cards, which tells you, you know, you're aware of, like, DJZ, if you're flying in on into any sort of operation and you're on a helicopter, it's a white card. You're on a white card. So that helicopter have a white card with all the names on it. That's it. If you're an amphibious craft or landing craft, you're on a green card. So it's an amphibious thing we use. So white cards, aviation, green cards is amphibious or in the water. And but the white card hadn't changed. So my subunit, my Bravo headquarters was still on the original helicopter. So we all shook hands, big hugs. You know, these are really, at the time, these are some of my, you know, they were my closest friends. And then that was it, we're off. So I said, see you on the ground, see you after the first part phase of the mission. Got on the helicopter, and at the back of the 46, there's a tail gunner, and I was hooked in, sat beside the tail gunner looking out. There's no bins down that end, so one of my mates, Dante, was at the front, so he'd give hand signals down where we are, 2 minutes and all this, all right, we're coming in. So I was on the tail, but I was looking out, so I had my map as well. So I've got the door gun in front of me, you know, I'm looking at the back, we're following the path from Q8, up the roads. I can see the helicopter, which is half right out the back of my 46. That was my helicopter, and that's a helicopter. Then I get a tap to the front. 2 minutes we're running in, 2 minutes running in. So I followed it. We went across, followed the road up. You could see the oil bar, fires burning. That was on my map. Then we went across Boobian Island. We're coming into the L4. And then we started banking and banking. 2 minutes had gone. And then all of a sudden I realized we're back into Q8. Back into Q8. As I'm going, hold on, you know, what's happened to 2 minutes? Back into Q8. And just as I was looking around, I just remember seeing the helicopter half right of me, just flipping. And we're flying at 100 feet. And that's like close to me, and it flips, and then we're just, it's an instant blast, it's just explosion. And we're caught up in the blast, you know, we're caught in the wave of it. And then, and this is, I mean, you'll know this, DJ, more maybe, but we start leveling off, and I see this sort of like light bulb with massive flame. And I'm looking at it going, you know, as we're flying away, we're staying on a straight line. And I'm going, that's a helicopter. But it still hadn't, that image that I'd seen, you know, the helicopter tipping, it hadn't really landed on, you know, in my head. It sort of hit me by the time we got back. So we got straight away, got mission aborted. And this is like, and then we flew back and we landed on the division. And just as the helicopter's, turned itself off, tailgate's down, I'm walking off the back. I see this guy dressed in civvies, and I'm thinking, and it still has, because still, you know, it's noise, a helicopter, and everything else. And that this guy, and he gives it, I cannot remember. He said, "What happened to Dash 7? Dash 7 is that?" And I looked across where the helicopter had been. I looked at it and went, and just realised that all my mates had just died. You know, there's no way anyone could have survived what we just experienced. And I was like, going, and then I said. He said, have you got any press for you? Any press? I said, no, I've got, I know Oliver North, you know, former US Marine Oliver North, Nicaraguan counter, I think. He's on one of the other cabs. And he goes, no, I'm Oliver North. So the first book I met was Oliver North. And I said, no, it isn't. There's no other press, only you that we knew of. So I had to leave him there, and then I had to go and walk about a kilometer at night as it's getting, you know, we're starting to get, you know, sunlight now. And at this point in time, I'm dead because the white cars has gone back. Everyone's out. They're all dead. This is it. Who's on that list? You know, it's one of those sad things in it. But I was coming out. It was just getting light. The second in command, 4-2 commander, was looking at me as he was outside the comms tent with a communication radio looking, and he's staring at me. And I walked up to him, and I've known him for many years. And he goes, "You're supposed to be dead." And I'm going, "I'm not dead, but all the rest of the lads are dead." And he goes, "Who's dead?" I said, it's the Alpha headquarters. So that was a realization that, you know, and you know, the jungle drums beat so quickly, don't it? So everyone's going, "But I thought you were dead, this and that." So, but all the lads lost their lives in that. And we had to literally just re-roll, step up. So we lost all our command element, you know, apart from myself and a captain who stood up as OC. I stood up as Sergeant Major stroke, you know, quartermaster stroke, a troop commander in the squadron. And then we loaded up on Royal Air Force Aviation and went straight back in on task. It was quite surreal because all the orders we'd done was with our full headquarters. And all of a sudden we had to just run with what we knew. And then we were basically the lead element of the commando brigade into Basra. And the people I work with, the guys were absolutely unbelievable. They were incredible, so professional. And the things we'd done, like, you know, we were doing raids, we were going forward, we were spiking guns, we were, you know, capturing prisoners of war, sending them back, capturing weapon systems, with quite a few firefights. And you know, we, after losing all our lads, we survived with everyone. We got them all back.
All right. There's a lot of questions that come from that. First off, I want to know, do you believe in fate?
There's not a single order for the reason that helicopter should have changed on the night. Not that I've been made aware of, and I've been to the regimental inquiry, the coroner's inquest, and there's no reason for it to change. And unfortunately, I've got the guilt of sitting here when so many of my friends and their families are missing their loved ones. But I'm here with my family, you know what I mean? So it's a hard one to sort of always think about and land on and think how lucky you are.
And that was going to be the second part of it, was the guilt that you read. Now, I this moves us great into the next part, because I've heard you actually say that you've not experienced PTS. Am I getting that right from what I've seen in interviews with you?
No, it's weird. I'm a human being. I think I don't suffer, but I'm a human being. And when you experience some of the things I've experienced, you can't unforget them. I don't know the technique for unforgetting what you've seen. And also, because I'm a human being and I actually care about new humans, it's quite sad. You know what I mean? It's extremely sad, but it doesn't. My friends that have struggled, and so many of my friends have taken their own lives. I sometimes feel that they can't get away from that point on that timeline. You know what I mean? They stay at that point where the trauma happened, and then with other life experiences, whatever, it compounds it, maybe triggers it, but they can't get away from that point and move forward. Whereas I feel that whatever my, you know, coping strategy is, or even just, you know, the fact, you know, the way I am, I am moving forward, but I can't, and I don't want morally to forget those people that haven't got that ability to do it. But as a, you know, I'd say mental health wise, I am in a really good place. I am in a good place, and I like to mentor or support or explain how I feel to my friends that are struggling a bit.
So let me ask you then, and here's where the question comes up. When you left active duty, you decided you wanted to get a degree in acting. You had looked at going to college, but your wife told you at that time, why don't you stay with the reserve? Because it might be kind of hard to live with you if you're not the reserve. So when you say all of that, I have a question to that, and I have a very serious question to that. When you say that you're in a good place mentally, that you don't think that you've necessarily suffered PTS, a lot of your friends have because they stay in that place where the trauma's at, what's going to happen? Because in August, you step away from the reserves, correct?
Yeah, that's my last time as a... My last time on the books as a Royal Marines Commando was on the 8th of August, and that's it, 37 years done.
Yeah, so here's my question. What happened when it's all gone? There's no reserve. There's no way to live that life, to be with the mates, to do all of those things anymore. You're done with it officially, and now you are an actor, and now you are a civilian, and that's what you are. Of course, that's not what makes you up. Being a Royal Marine Commando is not what made you up. But I wonder when you answer the PTS question like that, or the guilt question like that, what happens when all of that's gone?
I think my strategy is, it's not my circle, both family and friendship circle, are very much steeped from that background. So I don't think I'll ever, and like I say, family-wise, I've got members of the family that are still fully part of, you know, what I have been. So I truly think this, and I think for any person that has become a Royal Marines Commando, they will always be a Royal Marines Commando. And you know this as well, DJ, for people that are whatever, you know, not institution or force, especially that bond and that teamwork, you will always be part of that. That always part of you. And that will be mine. But I think when I done my transition from the regular corps to the reserves, which I wasn't intending to do, but you know, that was it. I got right. Yeah, I've done my time. You know, I've had this I'm sitting in front of a computer screen with my reading glasses on. Imagine trying to call a fire mission in when he put me, sorry, lads, I've got to put my reading glasses on. Fire mission at grid. They're broken. They messed it up. So I realized.
In front of family members who are much younger and much more equipped to do the job.
Exactly. You know what I mean? So I can talk a good way. And I did. In fact, I realized in reserves, I'll tell you another story. But so I realized that I'm quite happy. I'm quite happy to leave. But it was my wife, and she just said, I think I think it was for all reasons, rather than just, you know, that instant change that. But my wife said to me, she said, I think you should join the reserves. She says, why? She goes, I've been at university. I know what it's like. You need to join the reserves. So I'm going, all right. So I did. And my first week at university, and it was nothing to do with, you know, people or anything. It was to do with possibly youth. So, I mean, I'm a conditioned 30 years like commando. And all of a sudden I'm training and I'm 47 years old, and the nearest age to me is like 23, and they're all wonderful young people. But the trials and tribulations when you're an 18 to sort of 21 year old compared to when you're a 47 year old grizzled veteran of wars is a bit different. So I was like going, yeah, I think I do need the reserve. So, and I have to admit that whole transition into the, you know what I mean, from the Corps into my life as an actor, I think the reserves were fundamental to helping get me through it. You know what I mean? And, you know, I've always been able to get in with the reserves and, you know, support them, whether it be training guys in Norway, doing, you know, taking for combat climbing in Cornwall or stuff like that. There, you know, it's stuff that when I love doing it, and I could do with my eyes closed. So really now, as it comes to the end, I know, and this is another one, I know you're itching, DJ, to get on to me, but I went climbing with the about 2 years ago with the mountain leaders course in Cornwall. It's quite hard if you've seen Behind the Lines. That first phase in Cornwall was quite a tasty phase. And I went climbing with a good friend of mine, a good Royal Marines mountain leader. And we were doing quite an easy climb. I was number two in the climb. And I leant round on this climb. I climbed so many times before, thought no problems about it. But my pec started to rip off. And when I went to hospital, there's me thinking I'm Peter Pan. When I went to hospital, the doctor went, what age are you? And I was like, I'm 53. And he goes, well, you're a bit old to be doing this, aren't you? And I was like, how dare you say this? But that was another. So again, that means when it comes to this, I'm going, it is my time to do it. I've done it. I've give back what I can, and I support what I can. But you know, it's me. I've got to be full on actor now.
You get a degree in acting. You go into a completely different world than the last 30 years that you had spent your life. I think we can agree on that. It's a completely different headspace. But you work with groups that are helping veterans, are realizing that post-traumatic stress is there, that are realizing that survivor's guilt is there. And you work on projects that really focus on that and try and show people that, hey, you know, there's a better way, there's a different way. And we talk about it a lot on this show. Let's go through your acting career, because once again, just like the rest of your story, it's crazy. You're a huge Shakespeare fan. Your wife doesn't necessarily like Shakespeare and doesn't get it, but you're a huge Shakespeare fan. All of these things that aren't necessarily, when people would look at a Royal Marine Commando with all those years, all that time in combat, going, oh, that guy is a lover of Shakespeare. He's a lover of the fine arts and stage and all that kind of stuff. How does it come to that? I have heard you say that you acted throughout your whole career, whether that was in boards or meeting with, you know, tribal leaders. How do you get to the acting stage of your career?
I didn't want to be an actor as such. I wanted to be a storyteller. So I looked initially at creative writing because I thought, right, that's it. But when I went to the university in the arts thing, there was a degree in acting with the Actors Wheel at Marjon University. And I looked at it and thought, well, that's the way we tell stories. I mean, you guys are the same, DJ. You think, oh, you're sailors, you're Marines, you know, anybody, you're storytellers in any of the armed forces. There's millions of them. There's numerous ones of them. That's what we are. You know, it's all about the team, the work, the action, and the story. You know, the story that goes with it. whether the high, whether low, whether sad or thing, it's a story. And it's incredible. You know, so as far as storytelling, but the way we tell stories is verbally. So I see myself as a storyteller, but acting was the way to do it. And I am, and it's a bit like when I joined the Royal Marines. When I joined the Royal Marines, I'm going, this is exactly what I should be doing. You know what I mean? You know, that was knowing you. And that's why I'd say to any young person out there, I know if you go, right, I feel I need to be this and do this, do it. Do it. No matter what anyone says, do it. It's yours. It's yours for the taking because you want it. Well, this one, because it was my choice, I'm going, right, I'm going to do this. And I have to admit, there's a few chuckles around the Royal Marines at the time. But I, straight away, when I started getting involved with it, you know, once I'd overcome this sort of age difference in the thing, I loved it. But I was initially, I was struggling with the spectrum of emotional needs as an actor. And then I soon realized that all my years in the core and the jobs that I'd done, to be effective at it, I think you build up a resilience to your emotional, you know what I mean? To that, your emotions are there, but you build up resilience to it because you have to do the job. You have to carry on. You've got the mission, achieve it. And I feel that, I think every service person or every person in service, and I'd say, you know, in blue light services, they build up a resistance to what they're exposed to and what they have to deal with. Because again, and they have to be able to continue it. So when it came to, you know, they're spinning, like, to become emotional when you become sad as an actor and you have to dive into, and I've got all this world of sadness and emotion stretching all the way back to Ireland, you know, through to friends I've lost, you know, in Ireland and family and in wars, and, you know, so many friends I've lost. And I'm going, and I morally couldn't break down that wall to tap into, you know. You have to go and come to their memories to get the credibility as an actor, to, you know. And I thought, how much of a cheat am I going to be for using, you know, these precious memories and this precious feeling that I have for these people to get a good mark at university? So I had to sort of step back a bit and have a little word with why, or decision, why am I doing this and who am I doing it for? And then the realization is that I'm a storyteller, but the only reason I can be a good storyteller is because of my mates and because of those people and them being in my headspace, supporting me, doing what I'm doing. I make sure that every opportunity I have, when I'm being interviewed as an actor or whatever, I'm going, why are you an actor? I say, it's because my friends are dead, died in some sandy area, sandy place, somewhere around the world, and they'll never have the chance to do this. And if I can get a chance to tell them and you remember them and remember the sacrifice they gave, then I'm happy that, and I can use their spirit and their memory to make myself a credible actor, which I hope is working. But it's so important that that's the only reason. Otherwise, that, you know, that wall would be in there and there's no way I would go in there because I need their memories and those people.
Are you ever worried that if you knock down too much of that wall, it's going to stay down and all that stuff's going to come flooding in? Because we've talked about PTS, we've talked about survivor's guilt. Yeah. At some point, though, tapping into that, which you have to do, which is an honorable thing to do, are you worried that when that wall drops that you're not going to be able to put it back in place?
I have to say that there is a worry of that, but the strategy I have is to have the support of the people I have, you know what I mean, to be aware of, you know, where I am, to always tell stories and not, you know, not big them up in any way, but just tell the story so that it's always out there and you don't hold on to things and, you know, and challenge things if you're struggling with it. But I also, because I've worked with so many groups and support groups and veteran groups, I also know the pathways. So I've already got the signposts if I feel myself, you know, getting to a dark place or a bad place. You know what I mean? And that's a lot of my efforts now are to try and help those people that are in those or feel they're sliding into those places to get that, just get the signposts, because it's their decision to do it and follow it. I mean, there are so many of them, unfortunately, that have taken their own lives. And, you know, it's the same stateside, same in Canada, you know, and the same, you know, it's unfortunately it's what war does to people. And if you can, what I've seen, and one of the modules I done on my acting degree was the community centered actor. And a community centered actor was, you had to focus on, you know, something within a community or a community, and, you know, see if you can support it in any way. So from my community, as far as I'm concerned, was the armed forces. So I got in touch with the rehabilitation center for veterans and for serving personnel at the dockyard in Plymouth in Devon, and I asked if I could come down and do a couple of acting workshops. First one was focused on what we call SODS operas. It used to be called the Ships Operatic and Dramatic Society. So you do a SODS opera, and basically all the people get together, you know, in a command unit or a company, wherever you're deployed, or in a ship's company, you would get together and you would make a play. You know, you'd do comedy acts. Guys would do like different sort of dramatic sketches, normally taking the Michael out of all the officers and the staff. But the talent that I've seen over the years in these, you know, service people and Marines was incredible. They're probably some of the most talented, probably depraved in a lot of ways as well, but most talented people in the world. And so we focused on that in the first one. And then the second one, we done it on the Two Worlds of Charlie F, which was a play that was done by Pravo 2-2 about veterans coming back with physical and mental injuries from Iraq and Afghanistan. So there was an educational pack with that. So we've done all the classic acting things like warm-ups, everything else and that. But then we got them onto it. And this group of people that we had, the group of veterans, some of these veterans, I mean, some of them were Marines, Royal Marines, who I'd served with and were now, you know, in a very, very, you know, hard place at the time. You know, when they first see me, they're going, well, what are you doing here? I'm going, I'm an actor now. I'm taking you for the workshop. And they were like, oh. But then when we got involved with it, and I could see the transformation for these people to come out of themselves and be someone else, but run through similar stories in the environment that they were involved in. It was mind blowing. I wasn't expecting it to be, but it was mind blowing the benefit that these veterans were getting. And I from there, I mean, I started to get involved with Bravo 2-2, Soldiers Arts Academy, and we're working with Canadian veterans and a few US veterans as well, trying to get, you know, links to sort of like, you know, get theatre work done. One of the guys who works with Soldiers Arts Academy is a Vietnam veteran, lives upstate New York, incredible man. And he's obviously engaged and works with us. And he's working, comes over and stays in London sometimes and does some creative stuff and performance stuff. I realize how beneficial it is. And that's why I support the likes of these, you know, organizations. And there's a few other things that are ongoing that hopefully as they mature, I'll be able to sort of get out there as well. That we want to get opportunities for veterans, especially veterans that we could classify as overcomers, you know, ones that have had physical or mental injuries, been through the mill, through the trauma, but they're now getting themselves back on track, you know, with building their lives and everything else and that. And if those that have gone down the path of creative arts or the creative industry, give them sort of like, you know, pathways or signposts and get them into, whether it's front of camera, behind the camera, on stage, behind stage, you know, just different access to further training and maybe get them in the industry earning money.
Yeah, and let's not lightly glaze over it. Bravo 22 Company, they've worked with over 400 wounded, injured, sick, and veterans. It's phenomenal, the stuff they've done. And a couple of the things that you've done with your acting career that I don't think we need to go over, some of the shorts that you've done, Service No Longer Needed, A Royal Marine's Disposition, Unspoken. There's all these things that, you know, you really focus on helping that person or letting them see it from a different angle. Hey, if this guy can go through it, then I can go through it. And I think that's your whole point of doing it. So if we can, let's talk about, you know, Bravo 22 and the shorts that you're doing.
It was weird. When I started my actor training, literally the summer before I started it, I was still serving regular Royal Marines. So I had about, you know, I was on my sort of, you know, terminal leave. And I seen this, it was at the Armed Forces Day here in Plymouth. And there was the Theatre Royal had a stand, and it was for looking for veterans to do a stage performance. I thought, well, that's ideal. I'll get involved with it. And I got involved with it, and it was incredible. It was incredible. It was a full professionally driven, and we created the story, and it was called, the first play I'd done was called The Boots at the Door, and it was about veterans coming back from Iraq and Afghanistan. And I mean, I wanted to be an actor, but the storytelling and the depth of experience you have about that, those environments and those people and your own experiences, they really lend well to script writers and that, to help them create, you know, a credible narrative. Because we so see so many, you know, film, bits of film work and theater work, which it doesn't hit the mark. It's, you know, I mean, it's not a complete soul in there, and it's not founded on, you know, true stories. So it was brilliant. And we done Boots at the Door. That was incredible. It was a great opportunity. My lecturer was quite envious because I was performing on the biggest stage at Theatre Royal at the time. And we done that. And from then on, I've worked with Bravo 2-2, I'd say continually for the last, 7-8 years, purely because they fully support the full spectrum of veterans, just for those, especially ones that are suffering with physical or mental injuries, just to get out of that shell, you know, be creative, stand up, make themselves counted, paint things, create things, write poetry, sing, dance if you can, you know. And I'm thinking, this is brilliant. But it just gives, because everyone, we are who we are. But if you've got something you want to do, and this is a classic saying I got in one of my U.S. Marine Corps mates. He went, "Hey, Tip, spit, don't dribble." So he says, you know, spit, don't dribble. He taught me two things. One thing was, you stand out like a turd in a glass of milk, which means that you're quite old. And the other thing was, spit, don't dribble. And it's one of those things. So it gives the opportunity for people to spit and not dribble and just get out there and do things. And I enjoy that, especially because the quality of the people and the service they've given, let's give them the opportunity. They deserve it.
And I think with that spit, don't dribble, it goes even further. Say, either do it and give your all, don't give a half-assed attempt on it.
That's exactly it. Exactly it. Yeah, so I've done that, and I work with Soldiers Arts Academy, which is another organization. I've done a few plays there. And we've done a play in Toronto, Soldier On, and Unspoken was a brilliant play we done with Bravo 2-2. But I like that because it was based around an old veterans club with all the different sort of characters and the highs and lows. We also had you've heard the old Walter Mitty thing. We had like a Walter Mitty character, and we had and I was like the man in the corner, and it was purely based on my, should we say, generational life in Ireland through to my life now. And it was there was a point when I came back from Iraq where I think it was my wife was really, you know, when you're talking about the mental health thing and that, it was just, you know, when you're a leader, or you're responsible for like a squadron of men, you know, in war fighting scenario. And then you come back and you're then a father to, you know, a family, you're back in responsibility. And I felt I needed to have a time where it was just by myself with a bottle of whiskey, on my motorbike and a tent, and just, you know, to have a place where the only person I had to care about was myself. And it was my wife, who was incredible. She's the one that said, no, you need to be with us. That's where you need to be. And that's probably the most powerful thing, and it's the most right thing that was ever spoken to me and said, because she was completely right. And I'm thinking the character that I played in Unspoken, and I think in Sunray as well, probably never took that advice, you know, and just then that disconnection with what meant most to him, he probably lost. And that's why Unspoken was a really good play as well, because it went generational, because my great-grandfather died in the Battle of the Somme. He was an Irish Catholic just after the Irish, you know, the Easter Rising, and he died. And then my granny, his daughter, was born 4 days after he died in the Somme. And then there's obviously my family, then me, and then my son deploying in operations, which was quite hard, considering I just come back on my last tour in Afghanistan. He was going out, and that was quite hard.
Well, I think I would even argue that most of your characters, even like a Royal Marines disposition, go against that advice of your wife. They're alone. I mean, those shorts are shot where it's that person with their thoughts. They might be talking about a group, but a lot of your stuff is that person just lost in their own thoughts, talking to themselves. I think you would agree with that, a lot of the stuff that you've done.
Yeah. But I mean, it's, you know, and I fully agree. I mean, I like telling stories because, again, the Romary's disposition is a true story. And I know the man whose story it was, and he wanted me to tell his story. And I've done a play last year. I was in Buenos Aires for 2 months last year at the 40th anniversary of the Falklands War. And we'd done a play, although I wasn't on the Falklands, but there's the cast is three British veterans from the Falklands War and three Argentinian veterans from the Malvinas. And one of the veterans, Ruben, I mean, these guys are like brothers to me, but Ruben was sunk on the Belgrano and got recovered. Obviously, he was in the sea for a day and got recovered, you know, from that. And the other two guys were conscripts in the land battle. And then my two colleagues, the Brit colleagues, Dave Jackson and Shukram. Shukram's a Gurkha who captured an Argentinian patrol with his cookery. And Dave Jackson was the brigade commander, Julian Thompson Singler, in the Falklands. So I'm in there as an actor, taking over a role of a veteran. And for 6 weeks, we were performing in Buenos Aires, you know, in one of the main theaters in Buenos Aires. We opened up to the American ambassador, the Japanese ambassador, German ambassador, I think a deputy president of Argentina, British ambassador. And we had like a sellout performance for 6 weeks, 1,000-seater theater, stand ovation every night. And the emotions and the stories that I learned and got there was absolutely incredible. But it was so important to get those stories out. You know, and I go away. In fact, next week I'm off to Israel to do to perform it at the Israel Theatre Festival with the same team again, just for a week.
We're to it. We got to talk about this movie, Sunray. I can't tell you. I told you before in all of our talks that we've had before, I am so excited for this movie to come out. I've been following it for a while. It just looks absolutely fantastic. It's veterans, former Marines. The whole storyline of it is a war veteran calls on the friends to help hunt down the people responsible for his daughter's death, but he kind of learns about himself in this whole thing. We got to talk about this movie because we got to get people to see it because it is absolutely looks fantastic.
I do agree with you. I haven't seen the full film yet, but it's a really good movie. It's going to be a 2-hour movie. And it's currently with distributors and a few film companies are looking to get it up and running and get it out there, whether it be on a platform or in theaters. It'd be lovely to get it in theaters, but you know, it's a tough old industry. The guys that created this, the team, Dan, Sammy and James, they all former Royal Marines, filmmakers now. But you know, I've done loads of film work now, but you know when you meet people that really know their business, you know, they really have the eye for, you know, cinematography. I mean, it's quite spooky, and I've seen so many people, but these guys do have it. And because the story and the script, I think is brilliant. We've done it quite a while back now because obviously very tight budget, and we're just utilizing all the human sort of like, you know, gifts, the talent that's within in that grouping. And the talent sits at the top of it with those guys that have created it. So I've got a sneaky little smile. It'll be an incredible story, but I think it's a really important story, not only for moviegoers who want to see a bit of exciting, you know, I think credible storytelling, but I think it'll be good for all veterans out there, both, you know, all allied veterans without a shadow of doubt. They'll feel a bit of it because it's a bit of them. You know what I mean? It's a bit of them. And I think their families will see it as well. And I think it's important for families to see it to maybe help understand the, you know, the trials and tribulations of those, should we say, those mood swings that veterans have when they're, you know, they're still on the pathway to recovery.
Okay. Let's go over a little bit of the storyline of it. What your character is, explain what Sunray actually is, and then what you're doing throughout the film along with the other guys.
So Sunray is, I mean, I think it's the same in stateside. Sunray is the call sign in charge. So Sunray of a troop or a squad would be an officer or a senior sergeant. Sunray of a company would be a company commander. Sunray of a battalion would be the battalion commander. Sunray of an army would be, you know, whoever the general is in charge. So Sunray is the subunit command. In this, I'm Sunray of a four-man team, you know, who've served on operations, and they're a specialist four-man team, not unlike Brigade Reconnaissance Special Forces Support Group, maybe even an SF troop team and Special Forces team. But it's based on Royal Marines Commando. So we do a lot of specialist type roles, and that's where I think the team's firmly bedded in. So, and I don't want to tell any of the story, do I? I don't want to have any spoilers. So it's a story about trials and tribulations, but all I'll say is that my character is he's a broken individual. He's a broken individual due to his long time in service and exposure to traumatic experiences, which has made him lose a lot of friends. So it's not necessarily unlike me at all, but he's struggling a lot harder than I am. And it doesn't all end good either. So can we say that? I don't want to give anything away.
Yeah, don't give the ending away. I don't want that for sure. When you started doing this, when you started making this Sunray, this has been quite a process. It's been going for, I think, probably a little over 2 years I've been following it. There was a Kickstarter campaign. There was a lot of stuff involved. How important is this film to you? Because I feel like the amount of effort that's gone into just pre-production, production, and now finally post-production and kind of distribution is way more than someone would expect it to happen, especially when you said people are kind of doing it on gifts and a small budget. People are giving way more to this than when you look at it should be done.
No, not completely. And I'd say even in the post-production, most of the stage, it was a two-man post-production team, a two-person post-production team. And I work on some seriously big flicks. They've got armies of post-production team, but we've got two people doing it. And I'd say not only is it a measurement of our budget, but it's a measurement of the quality of the guys that are putting this together. As a film, as a movie, I know it's punching well above its weight. And that's only from what I've seen. I really wish at this point in time we could show you a lot more, but I think we're on the cusp, and hopefully, DJ, in the next weeks, or, you know, hopefully not months, but weeks, then we're going to have, you know, we can start the ball rolling with the official trailer, right? But I'd say in the draft of the trailer, which I've seen, which the gang have showed me, it's quality. It still doesn't, I mean, remember, I'm an actor, so every time I look, DJ, at myself on screen, I'm like, no. And you can never retrieve it and do it again. Once that cinematographer, the director sees it, he goes, that's in the can. You can't do anything about it. I wanted to do well for the team and for all our people and for the people that supported it and have given all their, you know, their crowdfunding. So I'm sure that the people that have input into it will be proud of what we've achieved. But if we can get it out there wider, I think it will, you know, I think it's a good, credible story, especially in this day and age.
Yeah, I definitely think so. I am so looking forward to it. I think people should know not only seeing the film, but that they can buy merchandise that is part of the film, whether that be T-shirts, there's some hoodies, there's different things that can also help along with this. We'll put the link on your episode page so that people can get a hold of that. So with all this being said, 30 years, 37 years now total, an acting career, films, you've pretty much been around the world and back again. What's next for you?
I'm doing all right, actually. I've got about three theater projects lined up, which hopefully should take me into next year. I've got, obviously, I'm off shortly to perform for a while in Israel. Then back, I've been penciled for a commercial. And then after that, I'm writing as well. I want to write, you know, like what everything we've talked about, DJ, you know, about what my life, my background, the highs and lows. And to be honest, we haven't even brushed the surface of the nitty gritty of what I've done, how lucky I have been, the people I've worked with have been. And, you know, it's quite a unique look. I mean, everybody has got their own life story. You know, nobody has the monopoly on their excitement, but mine's, I think, it's quite a unique little insight to my world. And I think for people of our background, I think it'll be of interest. But I'd like to sort of get it written down, stop procrastinating and getting it written down so that there's a bit of a legacy for my clan to look at and just remember, because life is short for all of us and shorter for so many of our friends as well. But life is short for us. So if we can just put our story down, it's all about storytelling, and pass it on to our families, I think that's important as well.
You're right. We have just brushed the surface. I thought we should probably bring him in gently into your story, because there's so much with 30 years of it. I mean, there's so much deeper we could go on it. And I'm hoping to do that in a further episode with you, get really in depth into that kind of highs and lows of it. So let's talk about where everyone can find you, whether that be social media, the internet, email, however you want to do it. Let's let everyone know how they can get a hold of you.
Well, I'm Insta, Tip Cullen. I think I'm the only one on there, Tip Cullen. You'll see my rather, well, slightly more youthful head on there, but Tip Cullen Instagram. I'm on Twitter, Tip Cullen, and Facebook. I've got like a personal Tip Cullen and a sort of business one. So on there, I've even gone on to, what's the newest one? Threads. I've started Threads as well with Instagram.
They got you involved in the battle.
You don't really know what it's about, do you? I don't.
You can't direct message. You can't do any of that stuff right now. So I'm going to wait until you can do that, because let me explain to people how hard the communication was between me and you. We live in two different parts of the world, and the fastest way we could get messages to you, because you were awake when I was asleep and I was asleep when you were awake, so it was emails back and forth. So any way I can find to get a faster message to you or you to me will work for me, whether that be threads, whether it be direct messages, whatever it is. But I'm looking forward to any way that we can communicate faster with each other.
Nah, DJ, keep comms, my friend. I honestly, it's been really lovely to talk to you as well. I think, it's been really, really good. I've done a few podcasts before, but it's nice, and you're good, and you've got a good depth about it, and good quality questions as well.
Well, thank you very much. Anywhere else that people can find you, or anywhere else that people should be looking for you?
It's just Instagram, Twitter, Facebook, and I put most of my stuff out on Instagram for upcoming sort of events and that there. And let's just keep fingers crossed and upwards and onwards, and just keep telling those stories.
Sounds good. All right, guys, you know where you can find Tip. This is where you can find me. As always, you can find me on Instagram at @DTD_podcast. You can find me on Facebook at @DTD_podcast. And you can find me on YouTube, where all these conversations, they're in video form. But your one-stop shop, DTDpodcast.net. Tip's going to have his own episode page, and he sent me tons of pictures throughout not only his acting career, but his military career. They're all going to be on there. You can see everything, find all of his links, audio and video of this show, and everything you want to know about me. Let's talk about my amazing sponsors now, Mac Belts and Police Coffee. Let's talk about one of their belts, the Governor. It's laser cut from premium synthetic polymer with an impressive brake strength of 1,500 pounds. It's got a 1.5 inch width, and it's handmade right here in the U.S. by SOF veterans. We all know my buddy Mac Alexander, retired Navy SEAL, is making the strongest belts on earth. And we know that nothing stands up to wear and tear like a good leather belt. If you're looking for the toughest leather belt on earth, you've come to the right place. Mac Belts. They're handcrafted in the USA by veterans who are serious about their craft. And as we always say, that's who they employ. Veterans that are coming back trying to make their way in the world and change that chapter and that story that they're telling. If you're looking for a belt that's tough enough for your active lifestyle and help support those who've given so much to this country, look no further than Mac Belts. It's the toughest belt on the planet. MacBelts.com. Now let's talk about coffee. Police Coffee is an officer-owned business, and it's dedicated to crafting the finest coffees and blends, and they're shipped as soon as they're made to provide you with the freshest coffee available. Each batch is roasted fresh by people who know what it means to stay vigilant. Their specialty coffees do not waste one drop when flavor's concerned, and their coffee's some of the best you'll find. It also helps serve an important cause. They give back to my community. 50% of their profits go towards helping family members of police officers who fell in the line of duty. And if you want to talk about flavor, One Ranger, their newest flavored coffee you're sure to love. One Ranger is a flavorful, medium-bodied coffee with a smooth and sweet pecan flavor. Pecan coffee is probably the best combination in the world. It's rich, it's sweet, nutty, and buttery. Its flavor cuts right through coffee's natural acidity and gives you a smooth and satisfying coffee experience. So make sure when you go to policecoffee.com, you pick yourself up some. They have everything there. Ground, beans, K-cups, cups, treats for your dogs, everything that you can imagine. And if you put in DJK10, you get 10% off your order. Guys, that's going to be it for this week. Tip, thank you so much for coming in and telling your amazing story. That's going to be it. Make sure you check us out on the next one. That's Tip. I'm DJ. This has been the show. We're out of here. See you later.